This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday in Bangkok, more than 2,000 oarsmen rowed 52 gilded ceremonial boats along the Chao Phraya River in a rare procession to celebrate the world's longest reigning monarch. King Bhumibol Adulyadej ascended his throne 60 years ago, and royals from 25 other countries came to mark the occasion, including Emperor Akihito and Empress Michiko of Japan, King Abdullah of Jordan, and King Carl Gustaf of Sweden. Almost all of today's monarchs enjoy only limited powers, but even so, critics question their relevance. While the Thai king has intervened several times to quell political instability in his country, other monarchs remain distant and mysterious, almost otherworldly, and some, including British royalty in recent years and more recently the ruling family of Monaco, find their names and pictures decorating the front page of tabloids. Today, a closer look at modern monarchs. Who are they? What do they do? What do they cost? Do they help their people, or are they living anachronisms? We'll talk with Dickie Arbiter, a former spokesman for Buckingham Palace, with a Russian noble, and we'll hear the latest on the succession issues plaguing Japan's chrysanthemum throne. If you have questions about royalty or monarchies, if you have experience of good kings or bad, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, Comrade Rockstar, the life and mysterious death of the American who took rock and roll behind the Iron Curtain. But first, modern monarchs. Our first guest is a former spokesman for Queen Elizabeth, Prince Charles, and Lady Diana. Dickie Arbiter joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Nice to have you with us.
My pleasure, Neil.
Why do monarchies still matter?
I think monarchies matter a great deal, certainly in this country. There's been a monarchy for over 1,000 years. It's evolved over that period. We've had one blip, and that was in 1649 when Charles I had his head disconnected from his shoulders. And we didn't have a monarchy for about 11 years, and then it was reinstated by Cromwell in 1660. But there's been continuity ever since. And the monarchy seems to act as a catalyst and as continuity and stability in times of crisis. I mean, for example, last year, after the bombings in London on the subway on the 7th of July, there was, a couple of days afterwards, a two-minute silence. And the Queen stood defiantly outside the building of Buckingham Palace under the central archway, observing the two-minute silence as everybody else was doing throughout the United Kingdom. And in times of crisis, yeah, we do turn to the monarchy. I mean, in the Falklands War, certainly in World War II, the monarchy was seen and was around all the time and travelling around the bombed areas of London and the rest of the United Kingdom. So in times of crisis, yeah, we turn to the monarchy, but the great British people, do tend to find time to criticise it as well.
Sure, but it is in that sense an expression of the nation, of the state, as it were, as opposed to whatever government of the day may be in charge.
Yeah, most certainly, and you've hit it right on the head. I mean, for example, you know, people say, well, what about the popularity of the monarchy? Well, the monarchy's enjoyed a sort of 70 to 74% popularity, certainly during this reign, and the monarch, i.e. Queen Elizabeth II, has enjoyed a popularity of over 80%. So it's been stable, even in times of crisis, even in the worst year, as the Queen called the annus horribilis, or for your American listeners, the bum year, 1992. Even in that period, she still enjoyed popularity, and there was still no call for a republic. And interestingly, now that she has celebrated her 80th birthday, she celebrated her Golden Jubilee in 2002, she'll celebrate her diamond wedding anniversary next year, the Republican movement, which amounts to about 15% of the population, if that, now turn round and say the Queen is untouchable, and therefore they've retreated into their boroughs and we hear nothing from them. No doubt as she does get older and probably becomes infirmed, or which there's no likelihood of at the moment because she's as fit as a fiddle, they will crawl out of the woodwork and start making noises that we've got to reform the monarchy. But at the moment, she is untouchable and she is popular.
There are about 10 monarchies overall in Europe these days, most of them rather more modest and less grandiose than the British royal family.
Yeah, they do their own thing. I mean, the European monarchies, and we lump Scandinavia in with that as well, because we've got Norway, Sweden, Denmark, then on the European mainland, Belgium, Spain and Holland, and of course the United Kingdom. Interestingly enough, Queen Elizabeth II, while head of state in the United Kingdom, is also head of state of 15 Commonwealth countries, and that includes Canada, north of you, Australia, New Zealand, and 13 other countries, while the other monarchs, they remain monarchs of their own countries. The newest of the monarchs, of course, is Spain. Juan Carlos was brought back to the throne. Franco introduced the monarchy back into the Spanish system just before he died, and Juan Carlos has been there since 1975. So, you know, it does work in Europe, and there is at the moment no call for change.
Well, Juan Carlos, of course, played an important part in the transition from the Franco regime to a more democratic government afterwards, and indeed, at moments of crisis, he did perform the role of being a national figure around whom people could rally. Yet in many parts of Europe, it seems that monarchs, the impression one gets is their primary advantage to the country is a tourist attraction.
Well, they're not just a tourist attraction. They act as ambassadors for their countries, and I speak particularly for the monarchy in the United Kingdom and the sort of the strap hangers, as I call them, the Prince of Wales, the Duke of York, the Earl of Wessex, Duke of Edinburgh, Princess Royal. They are there representing UK Incorporated. Whenever they go abroad, they are there waving the flag for the United Kingdom, and they do a lot of good in that way. The Duke of York is heading up a trade organisation, a government trade body, and his role is going all over the world drumming up business for UK PLC. They do a lot of good. They do a lot of good for charity. You ask a charity to drop a royal from its patronage, and they will absolutely crucify you. And I can draw the analogy here when Diana, late Diana, Princess of Wales, backed out of her charities shortly after her separation in 1993. They certainly felt a financial chill wind blow through their corridors, because one minute they have a very high-profile royal acting on their behalf and drumming up funds in whatever way, whether it's going to a movie or a theatre premiere or a fundraising dinner. And the next minute, that royal is not there. And all of a sudden, people who would put their hands in their pockets are no longer doing so, because at the end of the day, sponsors like to pump the royal flesh in much the same way as they like shaking. They might not agree with the president, but they like the idea of saying, hey, I went to the White House for a dinner. And they'll dine out on that for years.
If you'd like to join our conversation about the relevance of modern monarchy, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Patricia is calling. Patricia, is it Carmel or Carmel, Indiana?
Well, we call it Carmel.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know more about the Governor General's control over the elected Prime Minister of Canada. I'd like to know how much money and wealth leaves Canada goes to the royal family in England.
Well, that's an interesting question. Firstly, Governors General are usually... good evening, Patricia. Governors General are usually are appointed by the government of that country. For example, the Governor General of Canada is appointed by the government of Canada, it is just a tick in the box by the Queen saying, yep, she accepts that, because she takes the advice of her ministers, whether it is her ministers in Australia or Canada or the United Kingdom. So she approves.
Canada goes to the royal family. And
no money from Canada goes to the royal family at all. None whatsoever.
I think the answer is none, Patricia.
Okay.
Thanks very much for the call. There were, obviously diplomatic situations. For example, the American invasion of the island of Grenada some years ago, back in the Reagan administration. Grenada, of course, the head of state is Queen Elizabeth II, was then,
yeah,
is now.
Part of the Commonwealth. The relationship between the British government and the American government at the time, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were bosom buddies. She stamped her trotters a bit, stamped her feet and pointed a finger at him, but, it all went away.
Let's get Mike on the line. Mike calling from Ithaca, New York.
Hi there. Yeah, I'd like to make two comments. One is, I've known two royal people from two different royal families, and I think I can say that in a way, being part of royalty is a kind of slavery, because they're born into it. They didn't choose the job. And yes, they do serve an important purpose as ambassadors and tourist attractions, but they didn't ask for that job. And there are some downsides to it, like the kids can't choose the professions they want or the boyfriends or girlfriends they want, and this is painful to them, and that their parents choose these things for them, and they're born into it, and they didn't choose it. And this is why I think these people are paid as much as they do, because even down through the ages when royalty had more power, it's a stinking awful job, and if it didn't have a lot of perks, people wouldn't do it. You know, even King Solomon didn't want to do it. His brother didn't want to do it, and that's how he got to be king, and he didn't want to do it either, but did it out of a sense of duty.
That's a very interesting points you make there, Mike. Firstly, Queen Elizabeth II certainly wasn't in line to do the job. She got catapulted into it when her uncle, King Edward VIII, decided to abdicate because he couldn't, and I quote, do the job of kingship without the help and support of the woman I love, or the woman he loved, namely Wallis Simpson. So she got catapulted straight in line for the throne. Interesting that you say they get paid a lot. Well, they don't get paid anything, actually. The money that the Queen, for example, gets from the civil list, which amounts to about £10 million a year, which converted is about $18 million. All that goes to pay for salaries and the running of the office. For example, it also goes to pay my pension because I retired 5 years ago from Buckingham Palace. So they don't get paid at all. As far as princes not being able to choose their girlfriends, well, William and Harry have put a stop to that because they most certainly did and have chosen their own girlfriends. Kate Middleton in the case of Prince William, and Chelsea Darby in the case of Prince Harry.
Britain is more enlightened than many countries in that respect. Some countries still have go through that state.
Yet both those princes have gone into the military, pursuing a family tradition. One notes that many of the sons and daughters of senior American officials have not done the same.
Give someone else a chance. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much.
The point you made, Neil, about pursuing family tradition, quite honestly, in terms of the royal family, is that they go into the Navy. William and Harry have chosen to go into the Army.
We're going to be talking more about modern monarchy when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Royals from 25 countries were in Bangkok yesterday to celebrate the King of Thailand's 60th anniversary on the throne. Today we're talking about what these modern monarchs really do and the role they play in their countries. Our guest is Dickie Arbiter, former spokesman for Buckingham Palace and Queen Elizabeth II. Of course, you're invited to join us if you'd like. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And of course, there are many former royals then as well as ruling families still on the throne. Bloody revolutions toppled the royal families of France and Russia, while politics knocked others off their thrones. But loyal monarchists continue to advocate for the return of their regal descendants to their rightful places. We're joined now by a member of one of Russia's noble families. Count Nikolai Tolstoy Miloslavsky is an historian and the author of Patrick O'Brien, The Making of a Novelist, and he's with us from his home in England. Good of you to join us today, Count.
Hello, good evening, Neil.
Why do people feel so passionately about monarchies, even those that have been long since forced into exile?
Well, I think they look on taking the case of exiled royal families, that people look on them with nostalgia as a focus of loyalty for the whole nation. They're above politics or outside politics. Because they've succeeded by hereditary right, it appeals to the sense of history in Russia in particular, where I go often and I now have dual nationality. There's a tremendous nostalgia for the old regime, not of course for the so much for the political side, but just for the fact that Russia was a great nation and that the monarchy personified the nation. It means an awful lot. The monarchy and the history of the country really are completely tied up together.
And has there been any evidence of an urge to a restoration in Russia at all?
Well, I wouldn't put it as strongly as that, but then nevertheless, there are, for instance, I'm in communication with a large number of monarchist organizations in Russia. There's terrific nostalgia for the empire, and in particular for the last emperor, oddly in a way, because though he was very likable person, as an individual. He wasn't, obviously, mm-hmm. great emperor. But I think the human side of it, the fact, of course, they were photographed very much and so very familiar figures, and the awful tragedy of their end does cause almost universal appeal, and the imperial family has been canonized by the Russian Orthodox Church.
Now, we think of royal families as people who ride to hounds in the morning and perhaps after changing clothes several times serve tea and have a wonderful dinner. I gather you have to work for a living.
Yes, yes. I mean, to take the British royal family, of course, they work extremely hard, and it's very hard to think of anybody else in England almost of the present Queen's age who works to the extent she does. I mean, I'm not as old as her, but I certainly wouldn't want to do it now at all, to wake up every morning and think that there's some duty. And the fact that you have nice meals, well, I'd enjoy that, but I don't think it's quite compensation in itself.
Your family, is there a great deal of money left, or do you depend on your work as an historian?
In my case, yes, we lost everything, of course, at the revolution, and but I'm perfectly content. I earn my living as an author.
And
additionally, my family.
I note you've written a book about the wonderful novelist Patrick O'Brien.
Yes, he was my stepfather, and I knew him for nearly 50 years, and he married my mother in 1945, and so I've written the first volume of his biography.
Now, you grew up in England, and of course there were family connections amidst all the royal families of Europe, but nevertheless, does that cause any difficulties when you go back to Russia?
No, because I have a British passport and a Russian passport, sometimes complicated when I travel, forgetting which one I ought to be bringing. No, when I'm in Britain, I'm a historian primarily, so I'm constantly thinking on the past. When I'm in Britain, I suppose I think of myself unconsciously as English, and when I'm in Russia straight away, I think of myself as being Russian.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. This is Dave. Dave's calling us from California.
Good day to you all.
Good day.
Hello. Good day. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I did want to offer an opposing viewpoint, and I don't mean to be personally insulting, but I would like to speak a little bit to the history of the royalty.
Yes.
It strikes me as based in a large part upon murder, incest, and Machiavellian plots going back many, many centuries, of course. The wealth strikes me, the wealth that they sort of revel in, really comes from the theft of resources from the developing world over centuries of the empire. I'm speaking particularly of the British Empire, but we could speak of other European countries too. And I think they're an absurd anachronism that really legitimizes a class-based society and terrible discrepancies of wealth and power. And I'd like to see an end to them all.
First of all, I think everything that you've said, obviously, there's a fair amount of truth in it because you're talking about the whole of history, and the whole of history is a long chapter of murders, wars, and so on, and the rest of it, which I don't think can be laid altogether or largely at the feet of the monarchy. And I have to say that republics have a long history and bloody history also. I mean, I believe there might even have been a civil war in your country. These are not caused by monarchs, and I would say that correspondingly, if you look at the modern world rather than the medieval one, that the monarchies of the world, right across the world, tend to be the most stable and prosperous countries. In Europe, for example, it's the countries on the fringe, particularly in Scandinavia, Holland, Belgium, Britain, and now Spain. They are the most stable and prosperous countries in Europe.
Well, they're prosperous, but they're prosperous because of the wealth that they've stolen from the rest of the developing world, and the games that we've played installing dictators and messing around in developing countries since we were kicked out of our former colonies. And so I don't really think that's a fair sort of like...
Well, Dave, certainly those same criticisms could be leveled at the United States, which is hasn't had a king since 1776.
Right. How did the United... What happened in 1898? How did the United States get hold of Cuba and the Philippines?
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. What we're seeing now is...
Well, that was a republic,
empires,
so...
the modern capitalist empires where the corporations have replaced the replaced the role that the monarchs used to play. And I don't have any more time for the American Empire than I do for the former British Empire.
I know, but you can't. The British, the great thing about the monarchy, or one of the great things, is that it evolves and is an institution which is particularly adapted to evolve. Firstly, because the individual changes in character altogether. He's not just simply inherits it, so it's in a sense luck, but that can be a very good system. And one can hardly say that the present Queen is responsible for the slave trade in Elizabeth I's time any more than you or I are responsible for what went on in our ancestors' time. So if we're talking about the monarchy today, we're talking about an institution which, of course, is different in different countries, but which has adapted admirably. And in fact, in the more modern British monarchy, Queen Victoria, when Britain ruled half the globe, she herself was famously immune to any sort of colour prejudice, and indeed, as far as she, as a constitutional monarch, she was permitted to do so, intervened on occasion in favour of people. And I've just been reading the other day when Edward VII was Prince of Wales and he travelled in India, he was horrified by instances he found of colour prejudice on the part of the British in India, and protested very loudly. So I don't think this has got any. This has a lot to do with history, but very little.
The Queen is the richest woman in the world, if I'm not mistaken. Why doesn't she?
You are actually mistaken. The Queen is not the richest person in the world. A few years ago, the Sunday Times in the UK, and it does it every year, it runs a rich list, and in the late 80s and early 90s, the Queen was top of the list until we tried to persuade them that she doesn't own the palaces, she doesn't own the royal collection, she doesn't. You know, she just lives in these places, and she dropped one year from number one to number 56. In the last list that was published about 3 months ago, she was nearer 200, so she's not the richest person in the world. This is a myth that has been allowed to become fact, and the sooner people realise that she's not the richest person, that she doesn't own the palaces, she doesn't own the Queen's flight, she doesn't own the royal train, she certainly didn't own the royal yacht, which no longer exists, and she doesn't own the paintings. She is just somebody who happens to have a portfolio of stocks and shares, like most people do, but rich she ain't. She's probably worth less than 100 million.
Probably having to scuffle for breakfast then. Count Nikolai Tolstoy Miloslavsky, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye.
The Count is an historian and author of Patrick O'Brien, The Making of a Novelist. Here's an email we got from Catherine, who notes that she's a dual citizen of the UK and the USA. I've always thought the monarchy was rather useful, except when too deeply mired in scandal, because they can do all the ceremonial tasks, thus allowing the prime minister to govern and allowing some criticism, whereas in the United States, the president is so revered, people are way too obsequious to the detriment of democracy. The president of the United States, of course, head of state and head of government. So that's a view from then. Let's get to Maureen. Maureen calling from Salem in Oregon.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
This is Maureen. Your last caller or email kind of answered my question, which was I've always been curious as to what the benefits are to the people in Great Britain to having a monarchy, because I'm sure it's costing them a lot of money. And they seem to just adore the Queen and her family.
It's quite interesting. Everybody always says the Queen and the royal family cost a lot of money. Actually, in conversion terms, the monarchy costs every taxpayer $1 a year. And I think on the basis of that we can pretty much put up with having a monarch. Nobody's too sure how much government costs and how much government waste. I mean, we've had scandal after scandal in the government about ministers having grace and favour homes, losing jobs and still retaining large salaries. So on the basis of how much the monarchy is worth, I can certainly afford $1 a year, and most of the taxpayers can too.
Well, that's a very good answer. That answers my question. I'm sure it's probably cheaper than what we're paying for our government.
Well, I think that goes without saying, Maureen. Thanks very much for the call. The Imperial House of Japan dates back over 1,500 years, but who will ascend the chrysanthemum throne upon the death of Emperor Akihito remains unclear. For more on the Japanese royal family, we turn to Ken Ruoff, the director of the Center for Japanese Studies at Portland State University, also the author of The People's Emperor, Democracy and the Japanese Monarchy, 1945-1995. And he's with us today from the studios of Oregon Public Radio in Portland. Nice to have you with us today.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Is the imperial house in Japan the oldest continuous hereditary monarchy in the world?
Well, that's what they claim. It's possible that it was broken once in the 14th century, but the official line is that it dates back to the 5th century, and that well could be the oldest.
Mm-hmm. Now, the line of succession has passed unbroken from male heir to male heir, but the current princes only have daughters. Why is this a crisis for some Japanese?
Well, for traditionalists, what defines Japan is the so-called unbroken imperial line, meaning that it's been passed down only through a male lineage. And traditionalists believe that if it passes down through a woman, then this feature that defines Japan ceases to exist, and it's a monumental disaster.
Have there been no empresses in Japan's history?
Well, there have been 8 empresses, but the key point is that none of them bore children who went on to hold the throne. It always reverted back to a male who was of male imperial blood.
Okay. Now, the situation, as I understand it, is at the moment there is thought of changing the rules and making it possible so a female daughter might ascend the throne.
Yes, there are no males among the current generation of imperial children. There are 8 girls. And the government was just about to begin the process of changing the imperial household law to permit for reigning empresses. And then it was announced that the wife of the second prince was pregnant and is due in September. And so everything was put on hold, and now we're just waiting to see whether this will be the male child that the traditionalists are so hoping for.
All right. We're talking with Ken Ruoff at Portland State University and Dickie Arbiter in London about modern monarchy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Cynthia. Cynthia with us from Kansas City.
Hello.
Hi.
I've always been fascinated by the monarchies, especially of Great Britain. I've studied a lot. And I had a question, the law of primogeniture that says that only the male can inherit the throne. In Great Britain, some of the greatest monarchs, like Elizabeth I and Queen Victoria, and now Elizabeth II, have been women. Why won't these other monarchies change their law? It looks like to me, as if the women have done a pretty darn good job.
Well, as Ken Ruoff was just saying, they're considering that in Japan, depending on the sex of the baby to be born. Ken Ruoff, can't they do a sonogram or a test?
Well, they certainly can, but they're not releasing any information about the sex of the baby. If, in fact, people inside the Imperial Household Agency know, they're not telling anyone.
And Dickie Arbiter, broadly speaking, is primogeniture still the rule?
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, of course, sort of pointing out that about Elizabeth I and Queen Victoria, there was Queen Anne and our present queen. Got to remember, too, Holland have a female queen, Queen Beatrix. She took over from her mother. Her mother, Queen Juliana, abdicated when she got to a certain age, feeling that she was too old. In the case in the UK, yeah, it is still the male line that takes precedence, but there was a talk of a debate going to take place in Parliament and the House of Lords to change that, but nothing really has come of it. As it stands at the moment, Prince of Wales is the next in line because he's the eldest. He happens to be male. And after the Prince of Wales comes Prince William, and if something happens to Prince William, it's Prince Harry. So we're pretty well stuck with men for the next 2 generations.
Let's turn to Kiyo Ken Ruoff before we run out of time. The Japanese royal household seems rather more removed from the day-to-day concerns of its people than perhaps even the British monarchy.
Well, in some ways that's true. They haven't had the scandals, but there are some important roles that the emperor and empress play. I mean, the present emperor and empress have had a very clear agenda. They've worked hard to wrap up the post-war, and they also work very, very hard to compress the margins the margins of Japanese society. In other words, by reaching out to people who are on the margins, mm-hmm. handicapped individuals, for example, they work very hard to integrate these people into the mainstream and to change mainstream views of people whose daily lives are very, very challenging. And so they do have a societal role.
All right. Ken Ruoff, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Ken Ruoff is the author of The People's Emperor, Democracy, and the Japanese Monarchy, and he joined us today from the studios of Oregon Public Radio in Portland, Oregon. And Dickie Arbiter, always nice to have you on the program. Appreciate your time as well.
My pleasure.
Dickie Arbiter, former spokesman for Buckingham Palace and for Queen Elizabeth II, and he joined us today from the studios of the BBC in London. When we come back from a short break, the story of an American cowboy who rocked the Iron Curtain and became rock and roll royalty in the USSR. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.